Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name is John, and with me, as always, is Steve. How are you doing?
Oh, John, I'm broke. How are you?
Yeah, nothing new there. Great.
Same old, same old.
Hey, so you were telling me before we started recording that we might find out who Satoshi Nakamoto really is.
Yeah, there's a lawsuit in Florida that alleges that one person who was supposed to be the co-founder or the co-creator of Bitcoin, who passed away, his estate is suing Craig White, who's had a long history of basically claiming to be Satoshi Nakamoto. And the idea is that there's a wallet that holds 1.1 million Bitcoin, which is worth about $70 billion or so. One key point in the lawsuit is that unless Craig White can access this wallet with his private key to say that he is, in fact, Satoshi, he may be out of a big amount of money. So either he has to be able to prove that he was the one who created it and had access to this great wallet, or he may lose the lawsuit and lose half his assets anyway.
So one of the negatives of claiming to be Satoshi Nakamoto,
Yeah.
you got to give us half. Hey, that you got to pay taxes on this. Hey, you got to register that now. You're like, oh,
Exactly.
wait, forget it. It's not me.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, he might be regretting. I wonder if he is regretting even claiming to be Satoshi Nakamoto with all the hassle
Well,
that.
I just don't see the upside. Is it just sort of to brag that you created this asset and launched it this asset class? I have no idea.
And then he hasn't even gotten to spend the money or anything, yeah? Because it's
Yeah,
all been
yeah.
in that wallet.
Exactly.
Interesting. Well, we might find out, or we'll probably find out it's another pretender to the throne.
It's another, exactly, another pretender.
What about Peter Thiel and his famous retirement gains?
Yeah, this
I
actually,
never really understood that. Well, how did that work?
yeah, this actually ties well into our guest today. So basically, this came out maybe about 6 months ago or so, but basically, Peter Thiel was able to buy shares in a private company using his Roth IRA at a very small price.
So he did this in a Roth IRA. That's the one where you pay tax at the beginning, but then you don't ever have to pay tax again. He paid like the 0.0001. He paid tax on, or he didn't get to defer that tax, but then he's free and clear on any gains and all that.
That's right. And he basically turned $1,000 that where he had access to this private company before the company went public at 0.001 dollars per share. The company went public and that turned into, I think, $50 million maybe. And then from that, he was able to basically use his Roth IRA as a vehicle to invest in other private companies. And he grew that initial $1,000 into a $5 billion behemoth.
Oh my God. So he did several of these where they just shot up. I'm still trying to get one little one. If it goes up three times, I'm so happy.
If only you had access to private companies before they went public, John.
So this is a hint of disapproval of inequality here is what I'm
Yeah,
sensing.
exactly. Just that. Or on the flip side, how can we all get access to this stuff, right? This is a pretty sweet pie. Can I get a slice of that as well?
We all want to be as successful as Peter Thiel with investing. But
We do.
fortunately, I have a lot of questions also for our guest today, Henry Yoshida, the CEO of Rocket Dollar, which actually helps you invest in things that your normal IRA or 401k doesn't let you. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, how's it going, guys? Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so how does this work exactly? How come I can't do this kind of any kind of investment with other banks, but Rocket Dollar lets you do Bitcoin or real estate or all these other types of alternative investments?
Sure. Well, the framing of the question, just so you know, is it actually comes back to the capabilities always existed. So remember, in IRA accounts, if you look at the history and how they started in the 1970s, they've never disallowed any investments into publicly registered securities or some derivative thereof, let's say ETFs, mutual funds, and so forth. It's actually the people who provide these particular accounts that sort of created this fork in the road where the vast majority of people basically only have these publicly re registered securities or think they can only invest in these publicly registered securities and so forth. So at Rocket Dollar, we're not an investment firm who creates investment products that are related to public securities market. People pay us effectively to get access to IRA and old 401k dollars they already have, keep the tax benefits, and then go make private investments. So I can help with the creation of an alternative capable IRA account. You'd have to go find your own next Facebook or PayPal type investment for Peter Thiel without me.
Yeah, if only. So you provide kind of like the legal box, and then it's up to you. You can put whatever you want into this box.
Whatever you want within the codified rules of the IRS for IRAs, which, you know, at its very most basic level, really only say that you can't own collectibles and life insurance inside of an IRA account. And then you just can't own investments where you personally benefit or you have control over it. So, for example, you can't invest in the company that you own. If you're the chairman, CEO, the board, or a large shareholder. Now, it probably uncovers a lot of your audience's opened investment accounts at various places all throughout their professional lives. And you always wondered where those questions about, do you own 10% or more of a publicly traded company? Do you work for a self-regulatory organization? These are standard questions that are asked on your investment accounts.
Oh, okay. So there's really no limits. I mean, or very, very little limits. So not baseball cards. What are those toys? Anyways, any of those, any, you know, oddball thing like that, but art, real estate, where there's commercial, residential, I mean, the IRS really, I thought there was more, the rules would be more complicated, but it's pretty open then.
It is very, very open. You just have to stay within these rules. Now, remember, most of the providers of the tens of millions of IRA accounts, though, they're in the business of providing custody to these IRA assets, but on the flip side, their business. So they're also manufacturers, and their entire systems are sort of geared towards being able to deliver some sort of product related to public securities markets. So in a way, and to their credit, they've never said themselves that these alternative investments are disallowed in these. They're basically more probably in fine print telling people that you just can't do those types of investments with us. So, you know, my goal is to take this capability that's actually already existed in an account structure that in and of itself is now a middle-aged human being in terms of age, if you want to analogize to that, and now allow people very broadly to just for a couple $100 be able to open one of these accounts and go do alternative investments if they have access, if they know about them, and so forth.
Oh, okay. So walk me through the process. So I have an old 401k and I want to switch it over to Rocket Dollar. How do I do that? And then get, let's say, my Bitcoin investments under that umbrella.
Yeah. So we're not that different. So remember, think of us as just another IRA provider. So you have your old 401k or your IRA somewhere, and you want to work with a different provider, maybe different investments. You know, maybe you want to work with a certain financial advisor. In our case, it's because you want to do alternatives. So we're releasing a new version of our site actually this week that now allows people in a 6-page signup, very standard, what you'd expect today, digital platform, provide your contact information so we can identify who you are to establish the account on your behalf. You open up one of these accounts in a 5-minute signup process. You establish an account number, and then you go through the process like you would with any IRA provider to transfer funds in. And once the funds arrive in our account, our product works very similarly to an IRA bank account. So you operate that bank account, and then you can deploy money into alternative investments that you've already decided that you want to do using our account. If you do it from our source account, it will be ascribed the tax for treatment of IRAs or Roth IRAs, depending on which type of account you have with us.
So we've seen maybe in the past 10 to 15 years, sort of the rise of alternative assets in investment. What do you think is driving that trend, and where are your customers putting their money as well?
Yeah, well, the trend, I've been in financial services. So I've worked with 401ks and IRA accounts since the beginning of my career. So I'm someone who very solidly came from this very traditional financial services background and still maintain all the licenses, certifications, qualifications, and so forth related to that. And the trend I saw was just more kind of out of necessity, in that as your publicly registered investment asset classes became more and more correlated to each other, then it actually kind of forced the investor community, typically starting with large institutional investors, to start venturing out and finding uncorrelated asset classes for capital that was required to be deployed for purposes of investment returns in the future. And more recently, you have platforms that have democratized access. And as you guys discussed earlier, maybe all new asset classes in and of itself, like cryptocurrencies, that have sort of just given people an avenue, an alternative asset avenue to be able to deploy funds into. And then I'm just sort of a natural evolution of that, which is that I help people tap into monies that are largely concentrated in publicly registered securities, but happen to have really long time horizon, really good tax treatment, and be able to use those dollars to make those alternative investments, which have become pretty mainstream. The increase in correlation between what you would traditionally look at as fixed income and equity investments has happened prior to, let's say, this low interest rate environment, which has been sustained for a long time. Both of these going together, plus the creation of asset classes and access to alternative investments, are kind of this sort of perfect storm, creating a lot of interest.
Interesting. Yeah, I actually, I have a friend who went from a fairly well-known financial services company to now working in a company that specializes in fine wines. And we've seen this, of course, with art, with the whole NFT art market as well, sure, with real estate. Do you see one asset sort of on the horizon that you think could take off in the next 6 months or so?
Well, and remember, from my lens, though, I do provide IRAs. So there's a lot of nuances here that I talked about earlier, that technically it's codified. You can't do collectibles. And, you know, this could be another episode in and of itself, in that if you securitize collectibles in the form of, let's say, this wine digital platform, or art, and you turn that digital and you sell pieces of it, or you sell it as a digital piece of art on a securitization site like OpenSea, that is it now a security because you securitized it, chopped it up into little pieces, and then sold it to investors for hopes of gains in those returns? Or is it still collectible because the underlying asset is still collectible? So, but to directly answer your question, I actually think that, you know, kind of the large dominant asset classes in the alternative space 6 months from now, let's say, are still going to be concentrated digital currencies, so cryptocurrencies, mm-hmm. and then real estate. I think there's a lot of people on the other side of the spectrum that need that yield and income, and they like the idea of income producing real estate, which is typically tied to something tangible.
Awesome. You guys just raised $8 million a little bit ago. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Where is a lot of that capital going to? What are the obstacles you have to remove?
Yeah, well, you know, thank you for mentioning the Series A round. I don't know. It's funny, people call you to congratulate that you received money to grow your business. You know, we're a company that probably more focuses on celebrating actual milestones related to that business. But for us, this money is going to be used to just continue making improvements to the product, and then continue to increase awareness that this capability exists, first of all, that people can probably match up dollars they already have that have better characteristics to do alternative investments. So I talked about this earlier, long time horizon, good tax treatment. I think those dollars are better used towards your alternative investments versus idle cash sitting in your brokerage account or your bank account. And then for us to take that awareness and just let people know that we've created a digital platform. Our team has a very long background in this space, so we're very well equipped, and we're the right group to do this, to basically make this particular capability, which is alternatives capable IRAs, a mainstream product alongside just regular IRAs, and now probably alternative asset classes like Bitcoin and others.
So getting the word out there is part of it. Because, yeah, great name, by the way. It's very catchy.
Thank you.
That should help.
There's a story around the name, too, by the way.
Yeah. How did that come about?
Yeah.
In a way, my oldest daughter, at the time, I was looking at and researching.
Her name is Rocket.
Well, her name is Liliana.
Oh, okay.
But at the time, I was telling her about some of the particular options or specific options I was looking at for naming this particular company. And, you know, Rocket Dollar was an available domain. I'd also been known for creating a company called Honest Dollar prior to that. So I guess in a way, dollars kind of stuck with me from a business standpoint after moving on from financial services. And, you know, she kind of got it. She asked me what the business did. And I said, well, in a way, we're going to let people do things with their money that they couldn't do before, put it in places or put it in investments. You know, again, IRA dollars going into alternatives is not a super well-known thing, although people like Peter Thiel have famously been doing this for 20 some odd years. And also former presidential candidate, current U.S. Senator Mitt Romney is probably another quote unquote poster child for this type of account. And she just said, well, I like Rocket Dollar. It kind of is the same thing. Rockets can take you to places that you can't normally go with a plane, a car, or with your bicycle. And it makes sense. You're going to do the same thing with their money. They're going to let it go places that they can't get to. So that's how we named the company.
She's very wise, that one.
Yeah, well, the thinking at the time, she was seven, that if my seven-year-old daughter can kind of understand the connection of this name, then that's got to be good for a good chunk of the U.S. population as we build this business.
Not everyone, but a good chunk, yes.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So you're focused mainly on the retail side, or do you also work with getting, like supporting advisors, like as a back end for alternative assets?
Yeah. Well, so we have a lot of advisors that actually reach out to us and are trying to learn about this product on behalf of probably a subsegment of their client base. And I come from this world. I was a longtime financial advisor with the RIA. And I was a 10-year wirehouse advisor, and then I had a $2.6 billion RIA as well. So kind of before I ever did fintech or tech. But right now, our outward focus is to go to the retail customer, go directly. And by virtue of doing that, we have a lot of advisors who say, hey, look, I have clients that are always asking me about these alternative investments. I want to do some research and learn a little bit about your platform. So we don't sell it through the advisor or sort of enterprise channels at all. But we have a lot of advisors who then sort of vet it on behalf of their clients. And then they'll bring 10, 20, 30, maybe percent or by number of their clients into our products.
And you send them a gift basket or something, I hope.
I send them something. But remember, it's financial services. So you can send them something that's logoed and something of pretty nominal value. And most people don't even ask. So I have, you know, $6 t-shirts I can send to folks with a rocket.
We'll give you our address later.
Yeah, they're cool. They're purple. I don't know if you can wear purple after a certain time in the year. This isn't a fashion podcast. So
yeah, but you're very fashion aware though. I appreciate that. Yeah. So what is the next obstacle you see as a CEO to getting the word out to what do you wish you could do? Are you working on?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I want to make our product as broadly available as possible. So, you know, one of the next steps for us that we'll be doing really soon is we'll be to allow traditional investments to go alongside these alternative investments. So it's capabilities that I know how to do on a digital platform just from my last startup. So we'll incorporate that. And that is not because I am trying to go and capture all of a client's money. It actually just makes our account more flexible. And if it's more flexible, it allows more people the opportunity to use our product because maybe they don't have an alternative investment at that exact moment, or an alternative investment cycles back out into cash in the form of a return and they need a traditional holding spot. So I think that's one of the things that we'll add. And, you know, the long-term goal for us is to really build this, you know, broad-based financial services platform, but starting with a beachhead product slash capability that captures and sort of acquires and is interesting to a certain demographic in a very sticky product. So just, you know, kind of MBA 101, we have a sticky product that's attractive to a certain persona of customers that we identify who open these accounts. And from there, it's probably my responsibility as a CEO to create other product features or other product lines that are relevant for that group of people.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of different ways you can grow. And it sounds like you've studied Porter's Five Forces also. Barriers to entry and
it's funny. I have some of those books. So my book stand is actually David Swensen's Unconventional Success. So I could have bought an adjustable height monitor to sit behind my laptop, but it's fixed in height, so it's about 2 inches too short in terms of being over my laptop screen. So Sure enough, you can use, you know, the late great David Swensen's Unconventional Success. And then the other one I have is actually also Michael Porter's book on my standing desk as an additional riser.
One of the C's, of course, is competition. Who do you see as your main competitor in the space? Is it sort of the traditional the IRA providers, or is it more the full service super apps coming down the pike?
Oh, yeah, good question. Actually, Gemini and Coinbase, can I getting into this space also?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Gemini and Coinbase, they're very interested and, you know, they're concentrated on being digital, digital currency exchanges. I think that's going to be their business model. I don't know if I see them trying to get into the world of creating crypto 529s, crypto, you know, mutual funds and then crypto brokerage accounts. If anything, they'd probably be a good partner of ours. One of our Series A investors is a major exchange. So we do have a financial relationship with Kraken. So the crypto exchange, another major exchange for us. But when I look at competition, I think it's going to be coming more from that traditional financial services space. It's just that, you know, there's a reason why we picked this particular beachhead product and capability, that there's a lot of room for us to grow as a business before the Schwabs, the Vanguards, and the Fidelities actually care about this space. And this goes a little bit to a point that you guys are getting at earlier, but I'll expand on that right now, which is that we basically get paid to create an IRA, or AKA people pay us to unlock money that they already have to then go do a private deal that they've already sourced, whether that's some real estate opportunity for a single property, a home on the other side of town from where they live, whether it's some particular cryptocurrency or an angel investment into a startup. So the reason why I think we have a lot of time to run is that internally, this would be a pretty tough project for a upper middle manager at an organization to say, hey, I think we should create this product that will then cannibalize all of our asset management business. You know, we're using mutual funds that we created based on trading and sales arrangements that we've established with financial advisors and brokers. And let's throw that out. Let's give away all those like 9 revenue streams and only make money so John and Steve and Henry can just open an IRA. And then whatever they go invest in, we can't charge a fee on that because it's a private investment that we had nothing to do with creating, sourcing, or managing. That'd be a tough like internal project to get past.
Hey, you've heard of Innovator's Dilemma too.
Yes.
Clayton Christensen.
That's right. But the point is that that's exactly why I picked this space. And this is coming from a person whose last business was a venture-backed robo-advisor, which was different, right? Robo-advisors are more set up to be digital distribution middle persons to distribute products that Vanguard and iShares largely were the ones that created already. So when that came to be, right, it made a lot of sense for internally these companies when they had the technical capabilities and someone showed them the way to do it very easily to just create their own robo-advisor because in effect, they're all distributing their own products already that they'd already created.
Yeah, betting against the large financial bureaucracy moving quickly, I guess, yeah, that when you put it that way, it sounds like a pretty good bet.
Right, yeah, either I'm very attractive to one or some of them, at which point, you know, this is what happens, right? It's risky for them. If they start to identify me, or maybe establish internal capabilities to try to do some of this, they've almost validated my space in a very big way.
So who do you see out there? Now, I kind of disparaged a little bit the large financials and their ability to move quickly, but do you see any fintechs or even technology companies that you see are doing something interesting or that you'd even like to partner with?
I think that the large fintechs, so let's just say the equivalent of the FANGs or the BRICS, the big ones in fintech, the blue chips. So let's think about these names here, probably Coinbase, crypto side, let's say Chime on the banking side, let's say SoFi on the lending side, and Robinhood on the brokerage side. Just use those four, for example. I feel like all four of those companies have a very unique sort of foundational product and early capability that they then scaled to grow into a much larger company in all four of those cases, publicly traded except for Chime. And Now, from that particular original beachhead business, they are now trying to expand and deliver a much broader financial services overall platform, right? So SoFi is getting into investing. So they went from lending to now doing investing. Coinbase is trying to get into other lines of business. Robinhood is trying to establish itself as just the dominant player. And they've also made forays into banking themselves and so forth. So they're all crossing into other parts of financial services to create a platform to then distribute down through the existing customer base, which was largely made on their original beachhead products. And they're all trying to diversify. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do. So think of it as like a situation where you focus on this one really great capability. So in my case, it's alternatives capables IRA. And when the company gets large enough and has a consumer segment that follows them or is a user of their products, then you start to test other products and services that you can offer them. So you expand after having a lot of focus for a very long time. And then when I look at maybe, so I look up to all of those companies, there are probably ways that we could partner with them. Maybe they're potential companies that show me the way to track for me to become this broad financial services platform. And then on the traditional incumbent side, I think that, you know, Goldman Sachs, for example, they acquired my last company. They're taking a very big chance to reinvent their own consumer segment within that particular company. They're creating an entirely new channel to go after a different demographic than the wealthiest 10,000 people or 10,000 families in the world, which was largely they were built on.
I was hoping to grow into that, but it turns out they're going down to me instead.
It's only right. Marcus for you, baby. Only Marcus.
That's right. Well, when they first launched Marcus, the online savings bank, it was actually, they took over GE Capital's online bank, and the original domain site was gsbank.com. And I had a notification set up the moment that that website went live, and it was a $100 minimum, or it was a $1 minimum to open a bank account at Goldman Sachs. I remember opening an account for $100 at gsbank.com and telling friends of mine that you know, I've done so well in my life that I now have 100 times the minimum to open an account at Goldman.
that's pretty good to do. And I have to say the whole strategy is basically, as you say, beginning small and sort of expanding and growing with your customers certainly works. In my case, I began with, I think I had a small Wealthfront account maybe a year ago, and now I have a 529 plan. I'm looking into other things as well. And kind of, I see how the more I use a platform or a service, the more stuff I want to just centralize into one location. So I think that the idea of, again, sort of expanding that and growing your business with your customer is really key to this entire thing.
Well, it's almost expected. You kind of have to continue to make your products or your services or your business better. I mean, maybe the three of us, depending on age range, I was explaining to my own children, Liliana and her younger sister, Gemma Day, that, you know, when Netflix started, what was amazing to me was the company's name has always been Netflix, sort of the word net, which indicates sort of digital and online, since the beginning of the business. But most of us started our relationship with Netflix by getting physical DVDs sent to us in our mailbox.
Yeah.
And then all these years later, you know, they've kind of, they then started licensing content and delivering it over internet streaming services. And when they needed to make their product better and better, then they realized that, okay, there's not enough content for us to just license all of the old Breaking Bad and The Office. We need to start creating a movie studio. And I've just seen the evolution of a company that's continued to just make their product better and better and better. And at the same time, the pricing of this product has always been somewhere, maybe it's gone from $9.99 to $13.99. But even in a low interest rate environment, I got to think that, you know, effectively, we probably pay less than the 2003 circa version of Netflix today.
Rocket Dollar, the Netflix of financials?
Well, you know, in a way, we do charge on a monthly subscription. So something that, you know, we did study business models a lot, and people like the idea of having this very predictable. It's a, the relationship we have with our customers are that, hey, you pay us upfront a fee of $360, and then an ongoing fee of $15 to maintain this account. That $15 is $180 per year to sort of stay and have us continue to do the reporting and the maintenance of your account. But that $180 is probably far less than the tax burden you would face if you just made these same investments using a taxable account or taxable monies over time.
right? Which you wouldn't be able to do, or it'd be much more difficult otherwise.
Right. Well, I'll tell you one thing. Of course, obviously, as you can imagine, that in the late 90s, early 2000s, an individual like Mitt Romney or Peter Thiel, you know, wasn't using an online platform for a few hundred bucks, right? They were paying sophisticated accountants and lawyers at a cost of probably five and six figures.
Well, to maintain this account. That is another podcast episode, because that's a whole industry in and of itself. They find every loophole, every international structure they can. Yeah,
exactly.
So you're like just in your fourth year now. What advice would you give to someone starting off their fintech?
Just
with a honest
one on the fintech side. Yeah.
Oh, one other one on the fintech side. What advice would you give for someone starting off that you would wish you had known?
Yeah, well, I think we're in our third year. We haven't hit four. Yeah, we're three. But, you know, it's funny. It goes back to having focus. We've mentioned a couple of books. We've mentioned very, very well-known ones from just business and titans that teach at some of the best MBA schools. But I live in Austin, Texas, and there's another book that I really like. Called The One Thing. And it's all about sort of focusing on and doing stuff that you can manage and being very sort of particular in what you choose to pursue in business or your product in the early days, because you're limited in resources, presumably, as a small startup, which you always are. But you just have to focus on an area where you could be really, really good. And that book was written by Gary Keller, who is the namesake behind Keller Williams. So he's a very famous Austinite.
I think he got that from City Slickers, though.
Maybe
that's the secret to life. One thing.
Yeah. One thing. So it's, you know, when I tell other startup entrepreneurs, they come with pitch decks and they'll start off saying what we had talked about earlier, which is that, hey, I'm going to build this super app. It's going to do X, Y, and Z and A, B, and C. You're going to be able to trade crypto, buy stocks, sell options, and then maybe swipe right and find a date for Friday night all at the same time. And the company's just started. And I just think that that's just too much for someone to try to do. You can focus on trying to be really, really good at one particular thing. And if you think about it, the greatest quote unquote startups that we think about today can usually be described in less than 5 seconds in one sentence, right? So if someone says, what does Airbnb do? They can pretty much give you the answer. What does Lyft do? What does DoorDash do? You can tell people what these companies do. And these are very large scaled companies worth tens of billions of dollars, worth more than some of the financial services incumbents that exist today. Yet you can almost explain their business in one sentence. And it's because they're focused and they're really good and known for one thing. So for me, I'm focusing on this alt-capable IRA. Now, the result of that is that I get a very sticky, captive audience of mass affluent Henrys, the high earners not rich yet. I allow them to buy private and illiquid investments inside of a tax-restricted account, which tends to be two good contributing factors for keeping a long-term customer. And then from that point on, my job is just like Reed Hastings at Netflix, which is to make the product that you've chosen. You've chosen to give me your money and be a part of our community. My job as the CEO is to make this product more and more awesome over time. So I can evolve from mailing you DVDs and you mailing them back to me to licensing great shows or creating shows that we originally source and created to you for the same price over time.
Yeah, you're right. You have to start with a good brand name to as a base. If you don't get one thing right, I'm not going to trust you for everything else. I love the Henry acronym, by the way. Did you come up with this? Is this a Henry by Henry?
I said it a long time ago, but you know, I don't know that anyone really owns credit for this. But in financial services, it's a pretty known term. You can Google it. It's all caps. Oh. High earner, not rich yet. Obviously, the acronym stands for Henry. But it is a highly sought after demographic for financial services and banking industries, because, you know, once you do find that once you become a billionaire, John, it's going to be very expensive to acquire you as a customer. Right. You know, they need to kind of do right by you when you're just, multimillionaire, like maybe Steve, for example.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Be cheaper.
On my way up. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It'll take less seafood towers, golf outings, and so forth, just like that Wall Street Journal story that came out last week was really interesting. It said millennials say, you know, no, thank you. I'm not interested in playing golf. which is kind of indicating that they were not, really apt to go work with the financial advisor community that we know.
It's really funny that you mentioned the focusing on doing one thing well. When we just saw, I think it was just last week, GE breaking up into three pieces, just because there was no focus behind it.
Right.
Each of the different names. And I think Toshiba is following in their footsteps. And was it Procter & Gamble? It's also breaking up into two pieces.
Sony's already done that a long time ago. So there's other companies that have done that just to, you know, sell off assets. I mean, in a way, the one that we talked about for Peter Thiel making his money was PayPal, which, you know, was acquired by eBay and then was spun out of eBay because they decided that it had better prospects for growth and opportunity, not being tied to the balance sheet of eBay itself. They split it back out. And oddly enough, today it has the same market cap almost as Morgan Stanley as we talked today, and Square's market cap is very close to Goldman Sachs. I don't know if you guys knew that or not, but
I did not know. That's actually quite fascinating. But we also see sort of the other end of it as well, where we see other companies, mostly in technology, kind of going back and becoming conglomerates, like Meta with Facebook, like Alpha Google. It seems like there's kind of a back and forth swing on whether to be a conglomerate or not. And then, of course, you have companies like Berkshire Hathaway and others that sort of, again, kind of seem to buck the trend.
Yeah, well, and that's part of their business model, though, too, right? To make investments into companies and let them sort of largely run on their own with the added resources and removing of redundancies and scaling sort of expertise that Berkshire Hathaway can provide. So that's built into their DNA. But, you know, if you really think about it, and even the companies that you just mentioned, too, Facebook's Meta, Alphabet, and Google, I mean, they may actually now have several dozen, maybe several hundred different business lines, but their businesses and their identity is largely tied to probably one, two, or three. That's the same at Amazon. And I would say outside of the business community, most people don't know what Amazon Web Services is. They know Amazon that you can go get a new charger sent to your hotel room because you forgot to bring one on your business trip.
Yeah, and they're just as dominant in the cloud platform as they are in the retail side.
Right, and
or so, more so.
But for me, right, you're talking about very, very large scale businesses in the early stages. For me, I think that if I concentrate, use my own expertise and background as someone who's worked in financial services for 20 years, I have a lot of deference and respect for this industry, advising, wealth management, financial services, and now fintech. I kind of feel like our team and I we're ready made, we're built, and people are investing in us to create a alternatives capable IRA that becomes ubiquitous and known. So I want the alternatives capable IRA conversation in 3 to 5 years to be a 50-50 conversation. So when I get on a podcast like this and someone says, what do you invest in with your IRA? Do you do the regular stuff or do you do a Rocket Dollar type account, which is probably no different than the last time you gentlemen went to the airport, where your family member might say, hey, do you want me to drop you off at the airport or do you just want to take a ride share there? It's a 50-50 conversation that literally didn't exist 10 years ago.
Rocket Dollar it.
Right. You know, if something like that comes about, but, you know, I guess in a way that would be ultimate success for us. But, you know, even if we're not the company to do that, I do think that in the very near future, this conversation about how and what you invest in with these types of accounts, you know, won't be the, oh, do you do stocks or do you do bonds? Do you use a financial advisor or do it yourself with a discount broker? The next evolution is going to be, are you buying traditional or are you incorporating alts?
Yeah, the growth of DeFi has definitely made that more palatable as well. I mean, you see all these exchanges and new ways of offering products. I think we have to really rethink everything about financials pretty soon.
I think so too. You know, the products themselves, the distribution of these particular products, and so forth. I mean, just like how, you know, we just talked a few minutes ago that Square and Square and PayPal are now going toe to toe from a size standpoint. So it's no longer a situation where, well, you know, these companies are great. You know, they got a cool product, but we got the balance sheet to do to be who we are at Goldman and Morgan. That doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I hope you remember us when you get bigger, and that we were good to you relatively early on. And we get you on the podcast to celebrate when you become a Deca unicorn.
You know, if we did that, it's probably less about our valuation and more that, you know, we really created a product that let people invest in the things that they wanted to invest in.
One will lead to the other, sure.
That's right. Yeah. You know, there's a term, they say, you know, if you impact millions, you probably are worth billions. I think most entrepreneurs...
That doesn't seem to be true of the podcast reach.
It might be, you got to think that guys like Tim Ferriss, right, are listened to by millions of people, and he's not a billionaire, but he clearly gets access and sort of insight into investing in companies that become worth billions of dollars. He's an early investor in Uber.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
true.
Because of that.
Yeah.
And we all know his name.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we all know his name.
Well, hopefully a lot of people, more people know your name now. That's Henry Yoshida, the CEO of Rocket Dollar, who's bringing you more and more options to your retirement accounts and soon maybe many, many other types of accounts.
That's right.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.